Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuliner. It's been 20 years since the 1994 election in South Africa that marked the fall of apartheid. And for the last year now, students and faculty here at the University of Missouri have been assisting the University of Western Cape to help preserve an archive of thousands of photographs, films, artifacts, oral histories, and other historical documents related to the struggle for freedom during apartheid. The Mayabuya Archive is housed at the main library of the University of Western Cape in Cape Town and Robben Island. Western Cape played a key role in the struggle against apartheid. And many of the thought leaders of the administration of Nelson Mandela came from that university. The MU College of Education School of Information Science and Learning Technologies and the University of Missouri Libraries is working with archivists in Western Cape to digitize much of the archive and make it available online. The two universities have had a long-running partnership that stretches back into the 1980s. The Missouri School of Journalism's role in the archive project is to tell the stories contained in the archive and expand on them. We'll be talking largely about that effort today. Joining us in studio today, Randy Smith is a University of Missouri Convergence Journalism professor and led a trip to South Africa for the project. They just returned about 10 days ago. Randy, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you very much.
Lauren Langell and Kevin Drew are graduate students at the University of Missouri who took part in that trip to South Africa. Lauren and Kevin, thanks for being with us. And joining us by Skype is Professor Harold Herman from the University of West Cape in South Africa. Professor Herman worked closely with the group that visited South Africa, and he's been working on the issue for decades and lived through apartheid. Harold, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
And for you and our audience, we'd like to hear what you think about the effort to tell these stories. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And so just to start, I mentioned it briefly there in the intro, but Randy and Herman, if you could help me a little just explaining about the archive, what's contained in it, and why it's important.
Well, the archive contains essentially the history of the struggle against apartheid. And it is one that has come together, it's vast, and it continues to still come together. So when you get there and you see tens of thousands of pictures, newspaper articles, even diaries and personal effects of people, is somewhat overwhelming to see how much has been collected over the years.
These stories all been gathered in recent years, or is something going back pretty far back? Tell us a little bit about the history of the archive.
Yes, you know, the struggle against apartheid intensified considerably in the 1970s after the Soweto uprisings of the youth, and in the 1980s. And the 1980s was a very troublesome decade for South Africa. As you know, in 1990, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. And at that time, the University of the Western Cape was heavily involved in struggle activities and trying to transform higher education. And one of the things we did was when the liberation movements, that would be the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress, and other groups were unbanned, and Nelson Mandela was freed, there was the space for us to do things that were banned before. I was a dean of education at the time, that we would establish the Mayabuya Archives, which was to be the archives of the struggle history, the struggle against apartheid. Linked to that, we established the Robben Island Museum, and our Missouri group of master students and Randy Smith interviewed the history professor, Andre Odendaal, whom we appointed to head the archives and eventually head the Robben Island Museum. So the University of the Western Cape then was instrumental in getting the archives going. And as the exiles returned, the number of people getting involved with the archives increased enormously. pre and post 1994, which, as you may know, was the year in which we became a democracy. So it was that period in the 90s when the archives grew immensely, and the Missouri visitors were surprised to see just how extensive it became. Lots of the struggle heroes associated themselves directly with the archives. Many of them came to work at the archives. And when the Missouri group was here, I showed them one piece of evidence in the archives, which was a list of more than 200 interviews on tape done with political exiles. And Randy Smith and the 10 students saw in the archives an enormous collection of materials, from photographs to posters to books to letters, writings of various kinds. We did not want Robben Island to become a tourist attraction only, but to really become a place which is sacrosanct and which we want to retain as the island, you know, where Mandela and other people were incarcerated, and where, with some reverence, we would then celebrate the freedom which came after the 1990s.
And so how has the archive been used up until now? I mean, how is it accessed? Is it mainly by visitors to the island and tourists? Who is looking at it now, and how is it being used?
Well, initially it was just as part of the main library of the University of the Western Cape, but also in some way separate from the main library. The university, of course, was also a place where people could visit to go into the archives. It was perhaps a better place to go and make detailed studies of the contents of the archives, whereas Robben Island was more a place for tourists and for people who wanted to see, you know, the cell where Mandela was incarcerated and the various other sites that the students can tell you about who were there.
So, Randy, first, how did the journalism school get involved in this project?
Well, I first heard about an MOU that the University of Missouri signed with the University of Western Cape back in the fall of last year. And it was essentially an MOU to help digitalize these archives. And I was a student back here in the late 60s, early 70s, and we had a Harry Truman class at that time. And every year, students got to interview the president, the former president. And I thought to myself, we didn't do any journalism around this at all. But the University of Missouri did essentially the Truman Archives. And I thought, since we're doing the helping with the archives, helping preserve the archives on a digital space, we need to get down there and do stories about those who were around Mandela. Mandela died last December. He was 95. And so a lot of the people that we talked to are in their senior years. And we wanted to capture those stories, which are reflected in the archives through journalism. What's interesting, too, to me is that during the 80s, the students here protested against apartheid. And University of Missouri, like a lot of universities, divested itself from apartheid investments. But we did even more. We went and we decided to start a partnership in the 80s, one of the longest partnerships, I think, that I know of in academic history, recent academic history, with a major university in South Africa that was, you know, it was the so-called colored university of South Africa. That is what how it was referred to under apartheid terms. So it seemed like that this was a good thing. And these students represent really kind of the future, the next step forward in that relationship from when you think back in the 80s, the protests against apartheid, and now we're documenting and telling the stories of the struggle.
Mm-hmm. It's a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today we're talking about the University of Missouri's partnership with the University of Western Cape in South Africa to tell the stories contained in a robust archive of material from the apartheid era. Joining us in studio today, Randy Smith is a University of Missouri convergence journalism professor and led a group of journalism students on a trip to South Africa for the project. Laura Langell and Kevin Drew are graduate students at the University of Missouri who took part in that trip. And joining us by Skype is Professor Harold Herman from the University of West Cape in South Africa. Professor Herman's been working on the issue for decades and lived through apartheid. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Join the conversation by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. So yeah, Lauren and Kevin, what were some of the big conversations you had there and some of the things you took away from that experience, I guess?
So, I mean, where to start on that question? I guess one of the interviews that really stood out to me, it was with a man by the name of Renfrew Christie, and he's a dean at the University of Western Cape. He's a nuclear scientist, and his goal through apartheid was to not let the government get their hands on nuclear weapons during that time. So what he did, he spent a lot of time incarcerated as well. He 2 years on death row, I believe. Luckily, he made it through it. But what he did for his final dissertation was how to destroy the nuclear plants without destroying people, the cities. So that was the story that we heard from him was, it's like, wow, this, you know, actually happened and not too long ago either. I mean, this was, you know, the early 80s, late 80s, and even early 90s.
Yeah, and so that has to be an interesting experience as a journalist, too, compared to covering a city council meeting here in Columbia or something like that, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, it's stuff that you see in the movies, and we were there experiencing it firsthand. So
sure. And Kevin, I wonder, too, some of your thoughts on just that experience being there.
I took away a lot of things that are kind of overwhelming to try and catalog, but one of the things that stood out was just the tremendous number of people. I mean, we know the main players from Nelson Mandela, Oliver Tambo, and so on, but there were so many people across South African society that were really committed to bringing apartheid to an end, and we heard a lot of their stories, and they were really touching. And these people were amazingly forthcoming. But there were a number of people that talked about it, and the one that stood out for me was a guy by the name of Russell Christopher, who was a security aide for Mandela. He had been imprisoned also, and he talked about letting go of the pain of the past, and that was really touching for me.
Well, actually, Harold, I wonder your perspective on that. He said something really interesting there that Kevin said that, you know, for many people, it seemed like this was the first time they were talking about this. I wonder your experience having lived in South Africa for so long. Obviously, this is something pretty much everybody could have a story about. How often do people talk about their experiences in apartheid? Is this really a unique opportunity for people there?
Well, you know, one thing you must understand about South Africa, in the apartheid era, whatever we did, where we went, who we got married to, where we stayed, all of that was political. Politics determined, you know, who your neighbors are, what you are entitled to write, where you go to school. I mean, I myself grew up as a so-called colored. I rejected the label. The school where I was, which I showed to the students in what we call District 6, the 6th district of the city of Cape Town, which was bulldozed by the apartheid regime, except for the school that I attended, which was the first so-called colored school in South Africa, but which had a huge percentage of the political leadership of Cape Town as either teachers or pupils at that school. So from our experience, for example, politics was involved in everything we did. We couldn't go to restaurants that white people went to. So you can imagine the kind of debate that was stimulated by those basic things, those basic institutions in society, which in a normal democratic society people would take for granted. It took a long time for us to actually get past that. So in that sense, I think the debate has been ongoing. I mean, I'm 71 years old now, but from the time I developed my political consciousness at high school, it's been an ongoing debate. But I think in terms of taking the message elsewhere and kind of interacting with people like the Missouri group, I think that was kind of new for many of the people. I chose a group of people sort of across the whole spectrum, from those who were involved directly in politics to others who were educators and so on. And I think for them, it was quite an experience to speak to a group of young people and a few academics, me and Randy and maybe one or two others, about their experiences. Like you heard, the experiences of Renfrew Christie, who was a white person who had been involved in the struggle and who in the area of, you know, defense work and nuclear physics tried to buck the system and tried to oppose the apartheid regime and landed up in jail for 7 years. And at the other end, you had struggle heroes, like you heard, one of the assistants, the MK person, the Mkhonto Isizwe, where the military wing of the ANC belonged to, and we had a conversation with him. And he, when Mandela was released, became one of Mandela's bodyguards. And across that spectrum, from ordinary working-class people who had identified with the struggle to people in universities like us who were fighting the system either from within in the institutions where we were or from outside the country. You know, I myself, the first time I heard of the Release Mandela campaign was in London when I went as a British Council scholar for the first time overseas in 1971. And that was the first place where I read Mandela's Rivonia trial speech, which, you know, is well known all over the world. Those things were not available to us in our own country. We had to learn about people like Mandela and Tambo and others in a foreign country. Mm-hmm. But I think after 1990, things just opened up. And that is why when these students of Missouri were talking to and asking questions to people, there was an openness and there was a sense of pride, a sense of relief that we are now a democracy where there's freedom of speech and when you can speak about anything without the fear of prosecution or landing up in jail. And I think that must have been quite interesting for the students from Missouri. Yeah. For me, of course, who lived through the periods where those things were not possible, it's even more fascinating that we could reach this point in our society where all those barriers that were created by apartheid have been actually taken away.
Yeah, we have that separation of time now, right, 20 years. Kevin, you wanted to weigh in on that.
Going into this trip, one of the things that I was interested in was looking at some of the common themes of how societies can kind of heal. You know, one of my personal heroes has always been the Czech dissident, then playwright turned dissident, turned moral figure Václav Havel. And you look at him and you compare him to Nelson Mandela, you can see some common themes. And I wanted to see how South African society was moving on, because the societies of Central and Eastern Europe have had a difficult time to try and reconcile the past. And it was really quite amazing to see how South Africans had confronted that and were looking to the future.
You know, I think there's a lot of interest in these stories, of course, around the world. But, you know, you were talking about how the people's willingness to talk about these in the past. I wonder, do you think South Africans have a lot of interest right now in accessing these kinds of stories and this archive material, since it is, even though, as Randy said, we're still not that far away from the situation, time-wise?
Yes, I think South Africans still have a lot to learn from those stories. You know, there's been so many things happening here, but a lot of those kinds of stories have not actually hit the ordinary people in society. And I think it's our duty, and that's why I'm so happy about this link with the School of Journalism of the University of Missouri. Because we don't have a journalism school at the University of the Western Cape. You have this wealth of resources that we have in South Africa and at the University of the Western Cape and the Robben Island Museum and also the Mandela Center of Memory in Johannesburg and Pretoria. We have all these things available, but it also has to be taken to our own population. I can give you an example. I've been involved in the past 2 years in starting to get the alumni of the University of the Western Cape, which was only established in 1960, to start getting together and talking to each other, which, of course, we haven't done. You know, many of us went to the institution under protest. We refuse to go to an ethnic institution. And I think for the new generation of young people, you know, we call the children who were born after 1994, we call them the born frees. Now, they are, of course, the future of the country. And I think it's very important for them to learn what happened before 1994 and also to see how we've gone through the process of becoming a democracy, of having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission under Archbishop Tutu and others in 1996, and how we've been able to reconcile the groups in South Africa, you know, the four major racial groups created by apartheid: whites, coloureds, Asians, and black African, and how we are bringing the various ethnic identities within the black community together. And I think what is within that archives and what is within the many other stories, whether they be books or whether they be discs or whatever, produced by people who were part of that old history. And many of them, of course, are passing on. We just this week lost the vice chancellor of the University of Stellenbosch. Now, the Missouri students were with me at Stellenbosch. And Russell Botman, he was a dean with me at UWC. He was a UWC graduate, but he became the first black rector, vice chancellor of the University of Stellenbosch. He was a major figure in the World Council of Churches and in this whole struggle and now in this new transformation project that we have at universities. So many of us will not be here very much longer. And I think it's very important that these stories be carried over. And I think the stories of the Mayabuya archives, these interviews, these books, these publications, I think is the crux, the nucleus of what we can use to build that new identity and to get the younger people to understand what happened in the country.
Right. Yes. So a big part of it is what Howard was referencing there, digitizing some of these.
But the idea, though, is to make sure that scholars of the future, students of the future, can be able to access these. Right now, they are, you know, pieces of paper that are really not kept in a cool room or anything of that nature, and they're in boxes. And it's really important to get those archived digitally as quickly as possible, so that they are preserved for the future. You know, for all ages to come.
And is the goal preservation, but also, I mean, is it distribution too, allowing people to be more accessible rather than having to go to the island to see everything? You know.
Well, you know, the way I saw a lot of people coming into the archives when I was there was essentially physically coming in and seeing that. So that means you have to travel a long way to do that. Digitalization will certainly make them more accessible to scholars all over the world.
I wonder, too, you guys actually went in and saw the archive.
Yes,
So I wonder your impressions, Lauren and Kevin, of the vastness of it, I guess, but also just, what you saw there, what you found there in the archive.
Yeah, well, the archives that we were accessing, they're actually right at the University of Western Cape.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there were shelves and rooms, and we, you know, we could have spent months in the archives. What was really cool is that we were able to go out and interview all these people who were touched or who were part of the liberation movement or who worked closely with Mandela, and figure out what their story was, then go into the archives and, you know, pull out maybe some photographs from that time or from the organization they were with, or even video. We got video clips. There's newspaper clippings. But, I mean, we were so overwhelmed with everything that was there that they had to offer that, you know, we could be in there for days.
I mean, digitalizing that, you would think would make that a little easier, right?
It's organized right now, but to have it organized online and then do what they've done at the Truman, with the Truman Archives, which is to create learning modules around this, and also to put the archives in engaging ways so that people will, I'm interested in that and what happened at that time, or there's something in history that I didn't quite know about, and to organize it in that way. I think digitally you can do that a whole lot better.
What do you think the future of this project specifically looks like?
The thoughts I have about the archives themselves, I was really, we were all impressed by the vast amount. And to say that this is 20th century technology might be a little misleading. The type of stuff we were looking at was early to mid 20th century technology. The newspapers from the 20s and 30s are you can tell that they don't have much, very few legs left on them in terms of survival. I was really touched by the staff at the archives. How I got a feeling that us MU students kind of descended on them, and they were a bit overwhelmed by us, but they were so generous with their time, and it was just amazing. They kept asking us, what else would you like? And it was pretty amazing. You know, I think the value of this stuff, too, is we can talk about, you know, the international themes of truth and reconciliation and societies that go through painful transitions and have to deal with the past, but I'd also say that there's probably value for the average person, you know. Professor Smith is right when he says that the lasting message from this is reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And I think that everybody has to deal with that at some point in their lives where they have some kind of painful moment in the past that they have to kind of confront. And I think that that's the value that this can give for anyone. Mm-hmm.
Professor Herman, I wonder your thoughts on that.
Yes, I think what South Africa has done, I myself was taught in the 60s by my mentors who were political icons in Cape Town that we would have a classical revolution within 10 years. And I graduated from high school in 1960. So that gives you some idea of when that was the prevailing notion. I myself never believed there was going to be a classical revolution. And if we look back now and see what we actually achieved, you know, we did not have a revolution in the normal sense of the world, say like a word like, say, the French Revolution. But we've had a tremendous transformation of our society. And we've had that against the backdrop of this creation of a spirit of reconciliation.
We just have a few seconds left, frankly, in the show. But, you know, I just wondered, again, what is next for this project? You mentioned that the stories are going to be coming out soon. But.
Yeah, we're in the process of putting them all the stories together. We should have them all done by July. Working on fundraising around the project would be number two. Number three, continuing to strengthen our partnership with University of Western Cape, promoting more exchanges, and planning for next year's trip so we can continue on with this project until everything is up like I think everybody wants to see it become.
Sure. Well, that is all the time that we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Randy Smith, a University of Missouri Convergence Journalism professor that led a group of journalism students on a trip to South Africa for this project, Lauren Langell and Kevin Drew, who are graduate students of the University of Missouri who took part in that trip. And joining us by Skype is Professor Harold Herman from the University of West Cape in South Africa. Professor's been working on the issue of remembering the history of apartheid for decades now, and he lived through it. We'd also like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast. The Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection's a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection's produced by Janet Saidi and Maureen Lewis-Stump. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Lowell Thomas. Pat Akers is our audio producer, and executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.